This episode is brought to you by Groove Washer, the best record cleaners and protective sleeves for your vinyl collection. Ask for the Groove Washer from your local shop or go to groovewasher.com. Discount code VinylGuide10. And now, on with the show.
Well, hey everyone, it's Nate. Welcome to episode 358 of The Vinyl Guide, the podcast for record collectors and music nerds. And today, we be talking to Doug Aldrich of the Dead Daisies. Now, the Dead Daisies have a new album out. It's called Radiance. I got my hands on a copy, and it is really, really fun. A great spin. The Dead Daisies are a hard rock band with what seems to be a rotating cast of members, and some very notable names in rock have been part of this band's history. Now, the Dead Daisies are the brainchild of guitarist David Lowie, whose family is quite well known in the world of business. We talked to Doug today about working with David and how being in the Dead Daisies is not like being in any other band. Also in the Dead Daisies is Glenn Hughes, whom you all know from Deep Purple, Tony Iommi, Black Country Communion, and more. And also, the Dead Daisies recently announced the return of Brian Tiki on the drum kit. So all up, the new album Radiance is really good, solid songwriting, and there's even an Easter egg in the vinyl package, which we talk about on the show today. Now, Doug and I hit on a lot of topics, working with the Dead Daisies, how the group operates, the rotating band members, Doug's time with Dio, Whitesnake, hard lessons in a life of rock and roll, and of course, vinyl records. Plus, there's an extended version of this interview, an extra 15 or 20 minutes or so, only for patreon.com/vinylguide supporters. If you like this podcast, you want to hear more, head up to patreon.com/vinylguide. There you'll find extended interviews, commercial-free episodes, high-resolution audio files, and much more. Podcasts, as you know, pretty much labors of love and make no money. So if you want to help support the show, keep it going, head up to patreon.com/vinylguide, and we thank you in advance for your support. Finally, if you love rock and roll, there are heaps of other episodes of The Vinyl Guide you could enjoy anytime, including Billy Gibbons of ZZ Top, episode 293, Tom Scholz of Boston, episode 297, Tommy Clefetos, episode 272, Susie Quattro, episode 263, Glenn Hughes, episode 257, Michael Schenker, episode 252, and literally hundreds more. Just subscribe to The Vinyl Guide in your podcast app. Scroll, download, listen, and enjoy. And now, enough of that chitter-chatter, let's head into the land of the Dead Daisies and speak with Mr. Doug Aldrich. Doug!
How are you, man?
I'm good, man. How are you?
I'm good. Nice to see you.
Good to see you, too. Where in the world are you?
I'm in my dirty, messy studio in Los Angeles, you know, on a break right now.
All right. Getting ready to, what, you guys rehearsing for the tour? What's going on?
We got a little break. We don't have a tour starting until, it is December 3rd. We start in the UK. So we got a little time off. We got home maybe it was like 2 weeks ago and just been, finally getting my house put back together. I had done renovation a couple of years ago and it just still hadn't unpacked everything. So getting that together. Now I'm in the studio trying to get this together. And
I moved into my house 15 years ago and I still haven't got it together. So that's okay.
I know. It's so crazy when you start going through closets and it's like, oh my God. It's like the amount of things that we collect, it's out of control.
Well, let's start there because this show is about record collecting. Do you have a record collection? Are there a few boxes of records somewhere scattered in your house?
I love vinyl records. I don't have a collection anymore. It's something that's on my bucket list. I'd love to get back into it, get some of the reissue albums that are available now. And I do have a lot of vinyl that I've played on, but I mean, there's just so much. I mean, we're talking, you know, as you know, thousands and thousands of dollars.
To put back together that collection that you probably traded for about 50 bucks in the 90s.
No, it was before that. It was in the 80s when CDs started coming out. And I knew that albums still sounded really great. But I thought it was pretty cool technology, and wanted to, you know, update everything onto CD. Mm-hmm. And now CDs are pretty much out of date now. Everybody's buying music online or streaming on a platform or whatever. Mm-hmm. And it's all changed. But for listening purposes, I would love to get a kick-ass analog system, you know?
Well, you have to ask Santa for that this year.
So I got a whole bunch of other things before the album, before the stereo and the thing that I got to get Santa to help me out with.
Now, did you grow up in a musical house? Did you have a lot of records around as a kid?
Oh, yeah, totally. I had a pretty good collection. You know, it's just my favorites from Zeppelin and Aerosmith and Van Halen and Deep Purple, UFO, Rush. Just basically 70s rock, hard rock. Ozzy. My older sister turned me on to Jeff Beck. And the first album that I really think really loved by him was Blow by Blow. I heard that in headphones and just it blew me away. And my younger sister had Kiss Alive and Kiss Alive 2 and Queen, A Day at the Races. And then, like I said, my older sister had some other stuff. She had some Eagles, Chicago. I got turned on to Frampton Comes Alive from her and Stevie Wonder as well. And then I got into Southern rock. I had really heavily into Lynyrd Skynyrd back in the early 70s. And just, you know, records started getting more expensive as I moved out of the house and got on my own. And I slowed down a little bit my collecting.
You started playing in bands relatively early. I want to talk a little bit about Mansfield.
Yeah.
1983. Was that your first time on record?
Yes, it was, actually. We had a single that we put out, and it had two songs on it. One was called Overdrive, and I think the second one was called Gonna Rock You. Typical for kids, you know. But then we wrote some more songs, and then I was just in that band. We were kind of building a club scene, you know, in Los Angeles at that time. It wasn't quite popping yet for like the way the 80s started to develop in Los Angeles.
It sounds like you were focused from a very early age on playing guitar. I mean, there wasn't really a plan B much to speak of. It was, you were just focused on.
Yeah, that's right. There was not a plan B. There should always be a plan B, Nate.
You know, some people say if you have a plan B, then you really don't have a plan A.
That could be, I guess. I guess I'm grateful that I had passion for something so much. But a plan B sure would be nice sometimes. You know, not. I mean, for me, it's too late. But I know a lot of guys that, you know, it's just because of the way that the music scene has changed and the way that getting paid to make a living has changed. People get stuck. They're kind of in between. Like, had we all started in the late 60s or in the early 70s, it would be an even different situation. But as time goes on, I think it's gotten a little bit more complicated. The technology is great, but it's complicated to get compensated for your work.
Yeah. The music industry certainly has changes. And you've seen that change all the way through from, like we said, records to CDs to MP3s to Napster to streaming. Now we're kind of coming back around. The business of music has completely changed, and it's not in the favor of the artist necessarily.
Yeah, it's definitely, it used to be you'd make a record and you tour to support that record. And now it's the opposite, how you make a record to facilitate a tour. Mm-hmm. And we do, actually, the Daisies does do a decent amount of physical, you know, we have albums that we do, you know, vinyl as well as CD. And then you can download, of course, stuff that you would purchase or you can stream it. But we do, you know, we always sell out of the albums.
Yeah, absolutely. In fact, I've got one right here. I don't know if you know about this. This is a bit of an Easter egg I just discovered on the latest album, on Radiance. You shine a black light on it. Can you see it?
Yeah.
It kind of glows.
No, I did not know that. That is an Easter egg.
Yeah.
Is that a black light you have right there?
That is, yes.
Oh, cool.
How does an album from the Dead Daisies come together?
It started off, this new album, Glenn and I got together in 2020 and demoed up about 10 songs. And we were planning on maybe looking at doing like a concept album, something that management asked us to start to develop a little bit. And there was nothing much to do because of all the COVID lockdowns. So we got together and just wrote and demoed. And we had about 10 songs together in 2020, but then Holy Ground finally came out, and then we wanted to tour to support it. So everything kind of got a little bit complicated or discombobulated a little bit. And we were still planning on touring early this year when, you know, the Omicron came out and wiped everybody, you know, everybody's plans got wiped. So we decided we can't tour. We were going to be in Europe touring. We decided let's make a regular rock record, not the concept record we were talking about. And there were about half of those ideas that Glenn and I worked on felt like they would be standalone tracks and be good. And then we immediately, both he and I, started banging through songs. And then I went to New York and wrote with David for a week. And we just kind of, I want to say we all were working on coming up with as much material as we could. And then Ben Gross, who produced Holy Ground as well, Ben Gross kind of would come in and go, okay, I like this one, this one, this one, this one. This one I think is good, needs work. Maybe it needs, you know, for example, the title track, he heard it and he thought, okay, we need the chorus could be bigger, you know? So immediately I got some chords in my head and I said, what about this? He goes, well, that sounds great. You know, make a little demo of it so you can do it. And Glenn was cool with it. So stuff like that, we made improvements to. But I would say it's like almost like piecemealed it together a little bit. You know, it just, everybody working together to try and do their bit. And Brian Tichy came in and just elevated, you know, the sound as well.
So would it be fair to say that you and Glenn workshopped a lot of it, then brought in David, and then Brian at the end?
Yeah, and David had a couple of things too. That there was one song in particular that we had worked on for Holy Ground, but we never finished it. And I heard it. I was going through ideas, and I was like, why didn't we finish this song? It's called Born to Fly, and I couldn't figure out why we didn't finish, because it was kind of, it was really catchy and it had this a little bit of this Aussie rock thing, that the way that David plays guitar is a really, it's a very honest approach to guitar playing, very, you know, kick ass in your face, a lot of downstrokes, almost like a punk rock sound, and it had some of that. And then the chorus opened up and it was really melodic, and so we finished up that and presented that to Glenn, and we actually had a melody and the lyric for the chorus. And then Glenn took it a step further with the lyric and made it not just about literally born to fly, but like, you know, everyone's soul is born to fly. So that was cool. But yeah, I mean, I guess you would say in this order, Glenn, me, David, Brian were involved in the songs, and then Ben, you know, cause Ben would come in and go, hey, that section right there, it's too long. It's double long. And, you know, Glenn maybe had some, you know, when you listen to the demo over and over and over, a little bit, you get stuck in your head. They call it demoitis. So he wasn't really feeling very flexible, let's say.
Okay.
And I hadn't really listened to some of that stuff that we had done in 2020. I put it away and didn't listen to it. So when I heard it fresh, some of my notes kind of aligned with what Ben was hearing. And so I just, you know, my suggestion was, let's just try stuff and see, you know, see what happens. And And then, you know, most of the time we'd say that was an improvement. Sometimes we'd go, you know, maybe it was, I think we're going too far, or maybe we should keep it as it was, or stuff like that.
So tell me a bit about the operation of the Dead Daisies, because to me it's fascinating. Here in Australia, the Lowy family is very well known. Right. And David has a long background of just being able to manage operations of an organization extremely well, which
that is absolutely correct. Go, no, finish your question, but you're absolutely right.
How is being in the Dead Daisies different than from the other bands, and the contributions of someone like David and his background bringing to the group?
It's really interesting that you say that because I didn't know that he was. I didn't know he would the band would run the way that it runs. It's very much run like you would run a business. So people are, you know, have their strengths. You are delegated things that go with your strengths, and everyone's working together for the same cause. But we all have different, like, you know, everyone's got a little bit different strengths, so they try to utilize that. And so David, it's interesting how he sets it up, because he is the founder of the band, and he's the one that's got the investment into the band, for the most part of the investment. But yet, he's not the boss when it comes to business decisions. He basically takes himself out of that position, and he puts himself as a guitar player, as a songwriter, and that's what he does in the band. Of course, you know, if it was something where we needed to spend some money for something or whatever, I'm sure that he's, you know, has that in that situation, he's need to get that approved or approve it himself or whatever. But mainly he sets it up, so he's got management that makes these big decisions about what we're going to do, when we're going to do it, who we're going to do it with. And that includes decisions on how are we moving forward with social media, and how are we moving forward with new technologies such as like metaverse or different ways to connect with new fans, everything. So everybody's got a job to do that works, you know, it's working for like a company in this band. It's like run like a real company.
Yeah. I would imagine it would be an absolute dream gig, because not only are you working with some amazing talent, but you also now have the means to do things that a lot of bands just aren't able to do. Some really interesting ideas.
Yes. And also it's very, you know, we are taken care of in a way that if, like, for example, during the summer tour, a couple of us, David, myself, and two other people got COVID. And generally, you know, in a situation like that, it's like, okay, if you miss two or three gigs, you're hemorrhaging money. You know, you got to go home. The band has to stop because you can't afford it. You know, you don't want to be out there working for free. But this was a situation where, because of how things were structured, we could actually take a week off and hole up in a hotel and isolate and get healthy and then carry on. And that's something that I'm very grateful about. You know, we were able to do that. And that's thanks to David. You know, we're trying to build this band, and we can't do it if somebody gets COVID, we got to go home because we're losing money. It's nice to be able to say, hey, this is worth it. We're out here. The band is doing well. Crowds are great. We've got some great opportunities working with other bands. Let's stick it out, and it's going to be a payoff down the road, hopefully. So that's what we're able to do. And it's definitely a luxury.
Oh, I would imagine. If I look back at your career, you've been in various bands that have been chopping and changing members pretty regularly. So an environment like Dead Daisies, when's the last time you were in a band where the members didn't change for 4 or 5 years?
That's a good question. I mean, I think Dio, you know, well, Dio felt like that. I was the one that came and went a couple times, but the rest of the guys were all the same. Ronnie and Simon, actually Jimmy Bain, after I left Jimmy Bain. It's a good question. It's kind of a thing where as you get older, it's a little bit more complicated to keep people in the same direction. And Whitesnake was the same lineup for a couple of years, and then there'd be a drummer change, and then that would be solid for a couple of years, and then there'd be a keyboard player change. But the core of me and Rev and David was pretty solid for about 10 or 11 years, with a couple of bass players coming in and out. I mean, ever since probably the band Lion that I was in, that's kind of the only band that I can think of that was – And prior, you know, Mansfield. When you were in those bands, you weren't dabbling in anything else. There's nothing else to do. And once you're in the band, you're in the band because you're friends and you like the same kind of music. So there wasn't as many changes back then. But now, you know, as you get older and everything else, it gets a little bit more complicated. So you gotta embrace the change.
Was it originally envisioned for Tommy to play on Radiance, or was he always just in for the tour and the band was going something different?
He was always just in for the tour, and we knew we were going to do something different. He's a monster player. He's really good. I think that the idea that once Glenn and I started going through songs and stuff, we both talked about Brian Tichy and wanting to see if he would be interested in coming back. So our tour manager called him and said, "Hey, we're going to make a record. We want you to make a record and tour with us and get back in the band." And he said, "Great, let's do it." He had had a couple of years off doing his own thing, and he's did a lot of sessions over during the time he was out of the Daisies, but now he's back and we're keeping him busy.
I would imagine in your career, you've done quite a few sessions that have been under non-disclosure, ones where you perhaps can't talk about it or work for hire, but you can't tell anyone. Would that be fair?
There was one. There was a singer, great singer called Mark Bowles, and he was doing a solo album, and he asked me to play on his album, and I wanted to, but the record company in Japan was not happy about it because they were trying to promote Burning Rain, and I think it was our first album getting ready to come out, and it just would have been a little strange. And so I just said, "I want to do the session, but I got to do it under a pseudonym." And Mark said, "I don't care. It's a solo album. It's not going to be a band." So I did that. Then another time, and the only other time I can think of.
Is that under the name Earl Baker?
Yes. Earl Baker.
How did you choose the name Earl Baker?
My friend Chris Frazier used to call me Earl. I just don't know why. I can't remember why he called me Earl, but my dad's middle name is Baker, and I always liked it. I always liked the name Baker. But then with House of Lords, I did a session, and it wasn't with a pseudonym. I was just I was the main guitarist, I believe, but they had a guy that they were trying to promote as the, you know, it was a stronger look to have a guitar player that's on the album that even if it wasn't him on everything, he played a little bit on it. And then it sounded the way they wanted it to sound. And then it looked the way they wanted it to look, but the two didn't align exactly. Cause I had done the majority of the guitar work and he was the guitar player. Mm-hmm. That was House of Lords on, a record called Sahara. And eventually they got in rehearsal and they were really picky about the way that the songs were played. I remember I did some demos for them and they loved them. They said, "We want you to join the band." I said, "Well, I've already committed to a band called Hurricane. We've already we spent a bunch of money shooting videos, the record's coming out, and I can't do it." So I said, "Well, just do the session, do the album." And there were a couple of things where they had demo-itis, and they were like, "We love the song." There was a cover of Blind Faith's Can't Find My Way Back Home. Mm. And what's on the album is actually the demo tape that we did in somebody's garage in just down the road in Studio City, California. Because I played it better than the demo. It played it, but it was just slightly different. You know, I mean, the notes, maybe the bending or the vibrato, something. You know, I felt really like I it was better. But, and the producer, Andy Johns, felt that way. But the guys in the band were like, no. The demo is the one. That's it. It's got to be the demo. It's just, and so somehow we slipped it in there and it worked. And that's what's on the album. But then when they got in rehearsal, they were so picky about the way things were played. That guitar player they got played differently. You know, that's normal. That's yeah. Everyone plays a little differently. And they were like, it's not the same. He can't play like you. I'm like, well, let him play like him, you know, let him, it's not going to matter that much. But eventually they said, look, can you do a couple months with us? And that's what we did. I went and toured with them.
Hmm. You mentioned the band Hurricane, Slave to the Thrill.
Yeah.
Now, tell me a little bit about this album and don't forget about the album cover censorship.
We'll be back after these messages.
Hey everyone, I'm here to talk to you about Seems Easy record sleeve repair strips. Ever find a record in a used bin where the vinyl is gorgeous, but the sleeve has this ugly split and is even falling completely apart? Well, that's okay, grab it anyway, because with Seems Easy record sleeve repair strips, you can fix that right up. Seems Easy record repair strips repair seam splits from the inside, so it doesn't affect the appearance of a record sleeve, but it does make it functional again. With Seems Easy, records can now slide in and out like new. Turn a $5 used record into a $50 functioning collectible. Just ask your local record shop for Seems Easy strips, and if they're not in stock, go to seamseasy.com. That's Seems Easy with two Z's. Seems Easy record sleeve repair strips. Seems easy because it is. Oh, and hey, record nerds, don't forget to clean your records with the very best and safest record cleaner, the Groove Washer. Make your records look and sound their very best and store them with confidence using the new Groove Washer Groove Guard record sleeves. You gotta try this out. It makes a huge difference to the quality of your vinyl experience. Ask for the Groove Washer by name at your local record store and accept no substitutes. Or head over to groovewasher.com and use discount code VINYLGUIDE. 10.
All hail the Groove Washer.
That's groovewasher.com, discount code VINYLGUIDE10.
Now we return to the program, already in progress.
No limits. You mentioned the band Hurricane, Slave to the Thrill.
Yeah.
Now tell me a little bit about this album, and don't forget about the album cover censorship.
Oh, yeah. Well, it was a really, it's so politically incorrect, especially now. It's almost embarrassing to talk about, you know, because it's just wrong. It's just fucking wrong.
It was of its time, though, you know, so.
I don't know what we were thinking. I mean, I know where it came from. I'll get to your question in a sec, but the cover art, I had a shirt that somebody gave me. I was in Japan with Lion, and somebody gave me a shirt that it was like a bondage shirt, and I cut it up, you know, so it didn't look so bad. I cut the sleeves off and cut the neck out, and it just kind of couldn't really see what it was, but somehow that turned into like, let's do something like that. Like, I don't know if I can't remember if we had a song Slave to the Thrill or not. I don't think so, but either way, a really successful art director took it to the maximum level, and he built this mini, it was like a mini machine that he photographed, and then he superimposed the girl while she was laying down. He superimposed her onto this machine and Slave to the Thrill, and it was like, I don't know what we were thinking. It's just ghastly. You know, it's horrible. Yeah. And immediately got panned. And maybe we were thinking, hey, this is going to be controversial and that could be good. That's the only thing I can think of. Because I don't remember. I was like, wow, that's heavy. And then it did get censored and took the girl off the cover, which really didn't make any, then it really didn't make any sense. I mean, so it was weird. But basically what happened was I was in a band called Lion that had done an album that we really liked called Dangerous Attraction. And we were on a label that would not promote us properly. They wouldn't give us tour support. And the only way you could break a band at that time in the early 80s or mid 80s, whatever it was, mid 80s, you had to tour. You had to go out and show people what you sounded like live. I mean, that was the whole point. You'd go out live to sell the record. So we were unable to do that, and we wanted to get off that deal. And we made an album. We did get off the deal, and we made an album with a small label and show that we were safe and free. But just the band, we were not your typical Sunset Strip band. And so nobody really went for it. Eventually, the band broke up, but our management was the same as Hurricanes. And management asked me, would I like to join the band? You know, there was a small amount of money that we were on payroll. And so it sounded like, you know, it could be a cool thing. And there were a bunch of bands that had been hitting me up prior to that. And I just didn't want to leave to go audition for Dio or go join. I had been asked to join several other bands or whatever. And I just didn't want to leave my guys because we were all starving, living in a two-bedroom apartment. And our equipment was our furniture, like a couple Marshall cabinets. That was our table. So I just turned everything down. I just was like, I don't want this pressure. I want to be with my guys. This is my band. I believe in it. And eventually it broke up. So that's why I joined Hurricane. And we wrote some songs together. They had some songs already. And we went in the studio with Michael James Jackson to record. And I just remember that being a little difficult experience for me working with him. And not his fault. It was my fault.
How so?
I think I was just stubborn. You know, I wanted to go for a certain sound, and he wanted to go for a different sound. And he wanted things to be a little bit more lush, maybe, and rich. And I wanted it to be more raw and like simple. I didn't want it to be so many, you know, like we would double the guitar and it would sound really big, you know. But then he wanted to do some counterpoint lines or some top, Ben Gross calls them top lines. And now I realize that those top lines is sometimes what makes the song better. Mm-hmm. And at that time I was just really stubborn, you know, so I made it, I was a little bit, I think, difficult to work with him in his mind. But I didn't care. I was like, I'm sticking to my guns and that's it. And so we had a little bit of a power struggle here and there, but in the end, I look back at it as a real positive experience because I learned a lot that I've used that I learned from him. I just wasn't ready to accept it at that time, I guess.
You seem to be a very like fiercely loyal, even to this day. Correct me if I'm wrong here. If you think
no, I think that's important. You know.
Yeah. What's a gig you were offered that you almost got or didn't happen because of that loyalty to another band?
Well, that was the main one. Was Dio in 89 or 88, somewhere around there, or 89, I think it was. Grover Jackson, he was like, "What's going on with Lion?" I said, "I don't know, man. We're struggling. We've got some songs that we were kind of holding back, but we had to put a record out with a small label to show that we were really free because a lot of people just didn't want to take a chance on getting, I forget what you call it, but they were, you know, nobody wants to get sued by signing a label, signing a band that's kind of technically still committed to somebody else, even though we had paperwork that showed we weren't. And he goes, "Well, look," Grover goes, "look, Ronnie James Dio is looking for a guitar player, and I think this would be a really good thing for you." And I had never you know, when Ozzy was looking for a guitar player, I never went and auditioned. I never really, I went, the only time I had gone to audition was with Kiss when I was a kid. And that's a whole nother story. I'm sure you've heard it, but it basically, Dio said, I went in and we didn't even play. I just walked in and we talked a little bit. Then we went to the pub, had a beer, came back, we played one or two things. And then he's like, that's it. You got the gig. And I said, oh, well, hold on, hold on. And I got really nervous because I am loyal and I felt, you know, kind of guilty about that I had gotten that far, taken it that far. I thought, you know, there would be a period of time where he would be thinking about it and I would be thinking about it and kind of we'd both think about the whole situation and I'd have a chance to talk about business aspect of what it would mean. And he just basically was like, it's your gig. And I go, well, hold on. I need to, you know, speak to Wendy, speak to management and stuff. And I, you know, I told Ronnie, I'm a little bit, you know, uncomfortable with this because I have a group of guys I work with and I don't remember what he said, but I don't think he was super impressed with my loyalty. He was like, I just gave you an offer that a lot of people want and you didn't take it. Okay. Good luck, mate. You know, kind of thing. But then the band broke up, as I said. It just was unfortunate. And there was another band during that time that wanted me that was a little bit more of a, you know, the typical LA band. It was a band called Slaughter. And they had asked me about, we had done some jam sessions together, like Mark and I, and we got along really well. And he said he and Dana got this thing together, Dana Strum, they got this thing together called Slaughter. And I think you would be great in this. And I had just turned down Dio. And I think even Megadeth was calling. They were looking for a guitar player. And I just didn't pursue that at all. So I just told Mark, I'm not doing it. I'm staying with Lion. And I felt like a weight off my chest because I was like, okay, I'm committed to my guys. We're going to make this happen. Yeah. And it didn't happen. I think that, you know, things work out for a reason and I don't, you know, I don't have any regrets about it now. I look at it like I got it later, 10 years later, I got an opportunity to work with Ronnie and it was great.
Yeah.
And that led to Whitesnake and that was amazing. And I got, you know, I had to jump out of Whitesnake for personal reasons, you know, family reasons, relationship problems, being away and so dedicated to Whitesnake. I was really 1,000% dedicated to Coverdale. And he knew that. But at the end, I really was in a situation where I needed to get off the road and I needed to be a little freer. And then that led me, you know, to the Dead Daisies.
Doug, Dead Daisies, the new album Radiance, it is out now. What's next on the plans? You know, you're going to the UK for some shows. What comes after?
We are going to finish out the year promoting Radiance. And I want to say we want to come everywhere and play these songs. You know, they're meant to be played live. We've been playing them live in Europe and we did some in the US. We've got the UK. It's definitely a bucket list to come to Australia and play this stuff live.
So that's not on the plans yet, but it probably will be shortly in the new year, I would imagine.
I hope so. And we really appreciate, you know, our friends and fans down under supporting us and supporting, you know, the Dead Daisies prior to me, when John Stevens and then John Karabi were in the band. You know, it's really awesome. I've been there once and it was a blast. So I really looking forward, been waiting patiently to come back.
Well, Doug, thanks again for joining us here on the Vinyl Guide. Again, just let everyone know Dead Daisies Radiance, it's out now. Grab a vinyl copy if you can, because as Doug mentioned, they always sell out. And there's generally one pressing, and then the boys are on to a whole different record. This one sounds fantastic on my turntable. And again,
thanks,
Doug, thank you so much for joining us here on the Vinyl Guide.
Thank you, Nate. Really appreciate it. And I really like that shiny vinyl. I mean, that shiny cover. I'm going to have to get a black light on that thing. Very cool.
Kind of glow in the dark. It's kind of a hidden kind of, and it kind of.
How did you find out that?
Well, actually, I've got black light. I've got some tour posters here that they occasionally put black light paint on. And the other day I was showing someone the black light artwork, and I happened to have Radiance there because I was playing the record, and oh my God, Radiance, of course, there's black light ink.
That's cool. I'm going to have to find out if they did that on purpose or if that was just, would they have done that on purpose?
Quite possibly. I may have just blown a fun Easter egg for people. But I ruined a surprise.
I won't tell anybody. I think it's cool when you just let people find out stuff on their own.
Yeah.
I'm not going to, you know, if I do an interview tomorrow, I'm not going to tell them about that. I'm going to just let, you know, that's one of the coolest things. It's like, even like years and years and years later, when you find out something about like a Led Zeppelin album that, you know, if you look at it this way, it's like, what? I never knew that. You know, it's been 40 years, 50 years, whatever.
Yeah, some clever designer snuck something in and worked it out. Cool. All right, Doug. Well, take care of yourself, mate. Thanks again. And we'll see you down under.
All right. Cheers, man. Thank you.
All right. Take care.
Cheers. Okay. Bye-bye.
All right. What an absolute gentleman, Mr. Doug Aldrich of the Dead Daisies. Again, everyone, check out the Dead Daisies' new album, Radiance. I really enjoy it. It's on all streaming services right now. If you're lucky enough to find a vinyl copy, pick one up. As Doug says, they sell out pretty quick, and they're very difficult to get after that first run, so grab them while you can. And again, there's an extended version of this interview, about 15 or 20 more minutes, up at patreon.com/vinylguide. Head up there now, help support the show, and enjoy all the extras. That's it for this episode of The Vinyl Guide. Thank you so much for tuning in. Please share these episodes on your social media. Tweet them out on Twitter, share them on Facebook. But you know what also helps is actually showing people who have smartphones but don't know how to get podcasts how to listen to The Vinyl Guide show. Spend a few moments to show them how to work that podcast app of theirs. Subscribe to The Vinyl Guide and show them how they can be enjoying this each week as well. That is so appreciated. And we'll be back shortly with a brand new episode. So until we talk next time, get out there and buy some records, people. Cheers.
That's it for this episode of The Vinyl Guide. Send your thoughts to Nate at thevinylguide.com or follow or tag us on Instagram @vinylguide. Until next time, keep spinning.